Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello.
And welcome to Really with Tom and Dave,
everybody.
Woo-hoo. Assuming you're watching. If they're not watching, then ignore that welcome.
They could be listening.
Okay, if you're listening, that's fine too. If you're neither watching or listening, then that welcome is not for you.
Stay away. Come join us. We got to remember to do our say hello and
tell
stuff,
people
right?
Subscribe,
and subscribe.
Like and subscribe us.
To at Really with Tom and Dave on our YouTube channel. We want to see you. We want to hear from you. We want to hear all your thoughts about the show. Anything in your lovely brains that you would like to share, UAP related, cooking, possible recipes, experiences you may have had, jokes, anything you want to comment on. But yes, so we're also available on all the other wonderful podcast things.
We're on the Instagram,
mm-hmm.
right? We're on the TikTok, I believe.
We're upping S's and taking S's away.
Instagrams,
I don't know, but we are. And more importantly, how are you?
I'm well. Yes. Last time we recorded, I was sick.
Yes, so you soldiered through it. Yeah, you're better. Tummy's good.
Oh yeah, I feel fine. Oh, it's better. I was better by the next day. Oh, perfect.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. Are you just keeping it easy? Nothing too. No exotic foods.
I bought a street burrito today on the way home from the grocery store.
See, that's why would you time that? Why would you do that?
I just felt good about it.
I'm not a street food person. My friend Paul will get like the bacon wrapped. Hot dog thing away real quick. And I don't think I can do that in my advancing years. I mean, hats off to you. How was the burrito? It's good.
It was delicious. It was delicious. Okay. I thought the guys in my neighborhood all the time, I thought, why'd you try this? And I was like, on my way home. And so far, so good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I love being the canary in the coal mine for your intestinal issues.
Yes. I'm sure we'll get through this.
For our
guests from the other side, from the parallel universe called Australia.
Yeah, we cover it all here on Really. And we have a wonderful guest today. Mr. Grant Levac is an Australian UAP activist, researcher, and podcaster residing in Melbourne, Australia. Grant has held a fascination for UAPs, UFOs, since he was a young child, considers himself to be just an ordinary guy who believes in extraordinary things with a healthy degree of skepticism, and we approve of that here on Really, and an open mind thrown in there together for good measure. Grant frequently leverages the Freedom of Information Act to better understand Australia's involvement, or rather lack thereof, on the UAP issue, and engages both his elected representatives and the legacy media in the hopes they'll take the topic seriously and treat it with respect it deserves. All for that, Grant reports on his FOIA findings and engagement efforts via his podcast, The Unexplained Rundown, which is freely available on Spotify and YouTube. And we don't know what time of day we've gotten Grant up to join us, but if he will, he looks great.
It looks like it's the middle of the night here, but it's morning. I work in a dark,
you've got a very blue midnight vibe going.
The mood lighting, so I wasn't too sure if it would gel with the discussion today, but I'm sticking with it. So, but no, it's great to be with you guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. I've enjoyed your live streams.
Oh, very cool. Okay. You've seen a few. Well, yeah. I got to say, Dave, it's a bit of a thrill for me personally to be on with you guys, because I finished high school back in 1996 and I was about 16. To show my age a bit there, but I was a big fan of news radio back in the day. And if you had told me, you know, when I was 16 that, you know, some 27 years later I'd be speaking with Dave Foley about UFOs, I'd say, what are you smoking? So it's a thrill to be with you.
Grant. I'm still asking the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, you're slowly starting to get more and more of your co-stars engaged on the topic. So it's you and Joe at the moment, but maybe more and more over time.
Trying to infect everyone. Well, I mean, I infected Tom there with the bug.
Oh man, right down the rabbit hole. So Grant, I was friends with Dave, found out he was involved with UAP and starting to talk to all these interesting folks, and that kind of lured me in. And it's such an interesting time to be engaged with this issue. I can't imagine another time. I mean, there have certainly been some spikes throughout history, but this is a really interesting moment. How about you? Like, it says you were an enthusiast. What kickstarted this level of engagement for you? What was that process like?
Yeah. Oh, and I agree with you. I'd say what an exciting time to be alive, right? With everything's happened in the last number of years. But I've been fascinated by this topic ever since I was a young fella. You know, when I was 6 or 7 years of age, my father took me to a photo exhibition UFO photo exhibition in the U.S. Australia it was called the Centrepoint Tower in Sydney. And I remember they had these big blow-ups around the exhibition of black and white photographs of UFOs from decades past. And one of them was the McMinnville photo from the 1950s. And I remember just staring at that photo for what could have been 10, 15 minutes, just losing myself in, you know, what that farmer or rancher would have been looking at on that day, trying to immerse myself in the photo. And then over the years, you know, growing up as a teenager in Australia, you would have, you know, the X-Files play every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Then you do a big debrief with your schoolmates the next day. And so I've always kind of had a curiosity and fascination for the topic, but it really wasn't until, I guess, the bombshell December 2017 articles that came out in the New York Times that kind of really reinvigorated my interest. And then, you know, during COVID, we all had a lot more time on our hands. So I kind of became a sponge and tried to soak up as much as I could on the topic, learning as much as I could from as many as I could. And there was an event, a 3-day live stream activism event called the Big Phone Home 2, in which Dave Jeremy Corbell, your good friend, was in the first Big Phone Home. And it was really,
I think I was too. I can't remember.
Yeah, right. Okay. I was really, really inspired by just hearing from a lot of subject matter experts and people that are really, really advocating for greater transparency on the topic. And it got me thinking, well, you know, the US is so engaged on the topic, and there's greater conversations being had among congresswomen and congressmen. I thought it got me thinking, well, what is Australia doing about, you know, the UAP issue? And unfortunately, it turns out Australia is doing very, very little, even though that we have almost as long as a history investigating the UAP UFO topic as the United States, you know, dating back to the 1950s for Australia through to essentially 1996, when the Royal Australian Air Force just basically wiped its hands and said, move along, folks, there's nothing to see here. So Australia has really not been engaged on this topic for close to three decades. And with everything that's happened in the last couple of years, it's got me thinking, well, if you know the United States Congress and Pentagon is stating time and time again that UAP represent a potential national security threat and safety of flight risk, well, Australia being a Five Eyes and AUKUS partner, wouldn't you think they would be thinking, oh, maybe we should check in and check up on this UAP issue and get a sense as to what's going on and if we should be concerned about it down under. But to date, Australia, you know, the US and Australia are the closest of allies, yet their positions on UAP could not be further apart. So that's kind of been my driving motivation for the last couple of years now, is to engage my elected representatives down under and use the Freedom of Information Act process to learn what Australia knows or doesn't know and why it is continuing to be so disengaged on this topic when our US ally is taking it so seriously. So that's where kind of I am on the topic. And in the last really year and a bit, because of the documents that I've been able to secure for release through the Freedom of Information Act, I've had some really great people connect with me. So some really wonderful Australian researchers, Keith Basterfield, who's been very, very active as a researcher on the topic in Australia. Also Bill Chalker, more recently Ross Coulthart, and a few other researchers as well. So I feel like I'm standing on the shoulders of giants of those guys and have had the opportunity to learn from them directly and just try and pursue answers to questions that I'm curious on, like, you know, what is Australia doing about the topic and why isn't it taking it seriously? So that's kind of a bit of a summary for you as to to where I've come from, where I'm at.
I was going to say, my country of birth, Canada, is, I think, at least equal to Australia in doing nothing. On the US, I think they have your episode when you had Bill and Ross Coulthart on.
Yeah.
Recently, Ross brought up Larry Maguire's memo to the Minister of Defense in Canada. And in Canada, not only our Ministry of Defense just doesn't look at UFOs, they refer it all to Transport Canada, who also don't look at UFOs. So there's basically no.
So
one
go
in
to
Canada.
The post office. Yeah. Right, so yeah. Keep going, and you'll reach the. I'm curious: is it nothing they're doing, or is it? I mean, is it really nothing that they're doing, or is it the kind of old style U.S. like we're doing nothing about it publicly and privately we're doing a bunch of shit about it?
It's a good point you raise. So publicly, they're doing absolutely stuff all. They're doing nothing on the topic. They've tried to distance themselves from the topic altogether. They really haven't even acknowledged that UAP is a potential national security threat and safety of flight risk. Very much the Australian Department of Defence and Royal Australian Air Force believes it to be. Well, actually, I'll tell you. So this document that I secured for release through FOIA last year, it's actually the most significant document to come out of the Australian Department of Defence in more than 25 years. It was a Chief of Air Force brief on UAP. And the context behind that is that on the 27th of October of 2021, for the benefit of your listeners, an Australian senator by the name of Peter Whish Wilson. He's the only Australian senator to date that has had the courage and gumption to ask questions about UAP in Australian Parliament, in government. The only one, which is very frustrating, but it's encouraging that at least there's one that's taking it seriously. And so following the release of ODNI's preliminary assessment on UAP on the 25th of June 2021, Senator Whish Wilson asked the then Chief of Air Force in Australia about, well, what is the Royal Australian Air Force doing about UAP? Because our US ally and friends across the pond are taking it very seriously. And the Chief of Air Force's response was, no, we don't currently have any reporting or recording protocols for UAP. It's very much a United States issue, which the US has said time and time again, it's a global issue. And we know that it affects many, many countries around the world. And so Senator Whish Wilson has continued to press the now current Chief of Air Force on two further occasions in November of last year and February of this year, around the time of the Chinese spyballoon shoot down and three unidentified aerial objects. But you know, now for the last 2 years, the Royal Australian Air Force continues to, you know, toe the line and have it keep its head buried in the sand, and completely not acknowledge this topic whatsoever, which is incredibly frustrating, considering that Australia has always been lockstep with the United States on almost every defense initiative that the US has led the charge on. And what's even more concerning is Australia is about to spend $500 billion on three Virginia class nuclear attack submarines, part of this AUKUS agreement. To your point, Dave, you know, Larry Maguire, his letter, he raised concerns over a potential Five Eyes foreign material program that potentially the US and Canada has had these clandestine crash retrieval reverse engineering programs. So if it is true that the US and its closest ally across the border, Canada, has been reverse engineering some advanced form of propulsion and hasn't told its fellow Five Eyes partners about it, New Zealand, the UK and Australia, and we're about to spend $500 billion on technology that's going to be redundant or superseded by some form of advanced propulsion, I suspect Five Eyes partners are going to be pretty miffed. So that's the allegation, obviously, that Larry Maguire was coming out with his letter. But you've also got in Canada, I believe there's a project called Sky Project Canada
by the Science Council.
It's encouraging that you've at least got some scientific inquiry into UAP in your country, but nothing happening down under, I'm afraid, which is very frustrating.
What do you attribute that to, Grant? I mean, is it just a government attitude? I mean, is there something uniquely Australian about that? I mean, or is that just what do you there? I mean, is it that there isn't some? I'll have two questions. One is like, what do you attribute that to? And then, is there an Australian Roswell, or what would that be, or what would be the closest thing to it?
Good question. Yeah, so I think it's a couple of things. So this Chief of Air Force brief that I uncovered on UAP last year, what's very interesting about that document is in the table of contents, one of the items is strategic narrative. And so the Royal Australian Air Force is wanting to tell a story that UAP, it came to the determination that UAP are likely to be one of three things. Natural or other benign phenomena was one thing. It could be two, human sensor errors, or three, it's more than likely to be human-made technologies, either of an other nation system or potentially foreign adversarial. So it was somehow miraculously able to come to that determination of what UAP are likely to be or not likely to be without having, one, investigated the topic since 1996, two, in that document stating that they had not been engaged by the US on UAP at that point in time, and three, that they had absolutely no desire to collaborate with allies on the issue of UAP. So without having seen any of the classified data housed within the classified reports that have been provided to Congress, Australia is completely washing its hands and not even being open to the fact that there could be some catch-all other bin that ODNI indicated their preliminary assessment on UAP. Mm-hmm. And I suspect the reason why the Royal Australian Air Force is so reluctant to get back into the game is because in 1993, there was a briefing paper that was submitted to the then Chief of Air Staff, or the equivalent of the Chief of Air Force today, with a policy recommendation that the Royal Australian Air Force cease its investigation into UAP because it could not find any scientific or other compelling reason to continue to devote resources to the investigation of UAP. Now, that was back in 1993, and that policy was implemented in 1996, where the RAF, Royal Australian Air Force, just said, nope, there's nothing to see here, folks, move along. Fast forward to 2023, and we live in a very, very, very different time. So either one of two things is happening. The Royal Australian Air Force is reluctant to enter the ring again and get back into the UAP game because there is a fear of potential, the perception of a lack of public trust. If they've said that UAP is completely prosaic back in 1996. And now they're saying, well, hang on, we need to reinvestigate this because there's something to it. Our US allies taking it seriously. Then how could they get it so wrong back then that they're having to reinvestigate it again? That's one possible scenario. The other possible scenario is that Australia is waiting for the US to say, all right, you can now, it's okay for you to now enter the conversation. You know, essentially the US says jump and Australia says how high. So that could be another avenue as well. But I don't think that's necessarily the case, because on the 31st of May this year, current ARO, Alderman Anomaly Resolution Office Director, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, who sounds like he might be on the out.
I want to talk about that in a second.
Yeah. So on the 31st of May at NASA's public meeting on UAP with the independent study team, he revealed to the world that he had just held his inaugural Five Eyes Forum on UAP. So he had convened with Five Eyes partners, the US, Canada, Australia, UK, and New Zealand. Fast forward to the 19th of July of this year, where Senator Wish Wilson had submitted some questions to the Australian Department of Defence about, well, did Australia attend the Five Eyes Forum on UAP? And the Australian Department of Defence came back and said, and I quote verbatim, Australia did not attend a United States briefing on UAP. So they've had a formal invitation to enter the conversation on UAP, and they've rejected it. Now, that could just be the Department of Defence, and maybe there is a facet of the intelligence community in Australia that attended, but we don't know about, because a lot of the intelligence communities are exempt from FOIA, so I can't get any of that information. But it seems extremely odd that the ARO's director, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, used the word Five Eyes Forum and stated all Five Eyes member countries. So either he has, if Australia did not attend that Five Eyes Forum on UAP, well, then he's mischaracterized that briefing or that engagement with select allies. Because we know that Canada was represented at that Five Eyes Forum on UAP. Some of the great reporting that Daniel Otis has done out of your home country, Dave, he was able to confirm that the Canadian Armed Forces were represented at that Five Eyes Forum. And the reporting out of Defence Scoop, Brandy Vincent, was able to confirm that the New Zealand Defence Force was also represented at that Five Eyes Forum. So why the hell was Australia not represented? Why did they not accept an invitation?
I have one question. Is your military run by Neil deGrasse Tyson by any chance?
It could possibly well be, or even Mick West. I don't know, but you know, it's one or the other. But so that's where it's very confusing. And unfortunately, Susan Goff is not very forthcoming when I pose those questions to her. You know, were all Five Eyes member countries represented at Five Eyes Forum on UAP? I'm still awaiting a response from her. And the Australian Department of Defence, unfortunately, when asked questions by Senator Wish Wilson, they will just give a very, very short response. They won't volunteer more information than they need to. They'll just do the absolute minimum to address the additional inquiry. So there's two possible scenarios to your question, Tom, that I think might play out. Time hopefully will tell.
Yeah, and I was going to say, because you were talking about, I don't know if there's an even more parallel to Roswell, but I mean, Australia has one of the most famous and striking mass sightings of all time with the Westall School.
Absolutely, yeah, and I remember you were talking briefly about that on your episode with Jeremy Corbell. So for your listeners that don't know,
yeah, take us through that, please. Yeah.
Yeah, so on the 6th of April, 1996, in a school called Westall High School in about 45 minutes south of where I live, actually, I'm in Melbourne, several hundred school children at their recess time, which is about 10:15 in the morning, a schoolgirl ran into a science classroom and yelled at the top of her lungs, "There's a flying saucer, there's a flying saucer." And so when the school recess bell rang, all of these school kids flooded the school sports oval and reported observing between one and three, there's a discrepancy on how many, but one and three objects hovering in the skies above their school that resembled the shape of a flying saucer, and that they were witnessed in the skies above their school for a number of a number of minutes before, you know, one of them, or again, up to potentially up to three of them, moved off to a heavily wooded area about a mile south of the school in an area called the Grange. And several of, you know, several of these students reported seeing the flying saucer descend, land, or hover, you know, above the ground in this Grange area. And so I had the good fortune earlier this year of attending a Westall Witnesses reunion event. So they, a number of the Westall Witnesses, primary witnesses, meet once a year just to kind of, you know, keep their memories, I guess, fresh in their mind of what happened on that day. And so Shane Ryan, who is one of the, I guess he's, you know, I would say the authority on the Westall incident in Australia. He's one of the lead researchers that's done a lot of great you know, research on the topic. And he released a documentary a number of years ago now called Westall 66, A Suburban UFO Mystery. And so Shane told me about this reunion event. And so I thought, I didn't know a whole lot about the Westall reunion Westall event. So I went to this reunion event and I took my my iPhone with me, and I had a ton of questions based on the very preliminary research that I'd done at that point in time. And you know, there were five primary witnesses there at that reunion event, and they were all very generous and gracious and giving of their time, and they were willing to go on camera. So I just recorded them in long form format for a bit over an hour, just asking them questions about their experience. And their recollections were incredibly compelling. You know, I know, I remember one of them looking me dead in the eye throughout the whole conversation that we had, and just recounting and recollecting his experience. So very, very fascinating case. And what's so frustrating about it is that 57 years later, no official government record or explanation has ever seen the light of day as to what the Westall incident was or wasn't. So, and I know a lot of people have tried to track down documentation through the Freedom of Information Act, not just Shane Ryan, but also Bill Chalker and Keith Baskerville, and including myself. And it's one of those enduring unsolved mysteries. It's really a true cold case that defies explanation to this very day. So
what year? I'm sorry, what year was it?
66.
6th of April, 1966.
Oh, okay. All right. I heard okay. Okay. Yeah. That's, yeah, that 6th is. 6th of April,
1966. And I was going to say, and unlike the aerial school in Zimbabwe, that sighting, at Westall, it was the teaching staff also were witnesses. So you had the kids and staff, who I think believes a lot of that teaching staff are still alive.
Yeah,
still,
that's right. So
their story.
So a young teacher by the name of Andrew Greenwood, who only came out in the last couple of years, and Ross Coulthart actually brought him forward. He was 20 years of age on the day of the Westall sighting, and he was one of the teachers that reported seeing something in the sky. He doesn't know what it was. That, you know, it looked different to certain people depending on where they were positioned at what time the incident happened on the day. And there was also reports of another teacher that allegedly took some photographs she was part of, I believe, the physics department, had a camera, took some photographs. And then, as you would expect with, you know, any quintessential UFO case, you know, the military is reported to be on scene within less than an hour after the sighting, and the camera is confiscated. The children are told to shut up and not talk about it. The news media, Channel 9, was on the scene later in the afternoon, and they were stopped mid-interview, talking to some of the children, told to go away. So there was a report on the television that night of the incident, but again, quintessential, yeah, UFO case. The footage of that news report has since vanished or disappeared or been destroyed. But what I found to be fascinating is that the witnesses that I spoke with on the day, what really frustrates them to this very day is the fact that they were told to stay silent. They were told to say, yeah, "Shut up! You didn't see anything," and that's what really, I think, continues to irk them to this
one of the teachers
day.
Actually was threatened with having his career scuttled. They were going to claim that he was drunk at school.
Yep, that was Mr. Andrew Greenwood. So he had what he believed to be members of the military come to his home unannounced, unexpected, and uninvited, and essentially tell him you didn't see anything because if you do, you'll be made to look like a drunk and you could potentially lose your job if that allegation comes to light. So he was, he was a veiled threat for him to stay silent. And he did stay silent for many, many decades until only in the last 2 years coming out and admitting what he saw. And Ross Coulthart was the one that broke that information too.
Yeah. So. And weren't they, when they were visited by Australian military, but I've heard that they were also sort of accompanied by unidentified Americans.
Yeah, so one of the students, so there were a number of students that ran to the Grange area, you know, following observation of one of these objects descending to the Grange area. And one of the students, from my understanding, one of the students that was the first to reach that area, and there was a visible circular matted grass in the grain. So something, as far as they could tell at the time of their sighting, something had landed in the Grange area. And one of the girls that was the first to arrive at the Grange area and see those landing markings, she was pulled into a room later in that day, and she was questioned by, she didn't know if they're government or military, but I remember she commented that they had a distinct US accent. So there was quite possibly some form of US presence, government or military, on the day. So the men in black, as Joy Clark likes to refer to them. So, but it's just an intriguing case, and just one that is so frustrating because, you know, it is long rumored that the Department of Supply, which is now defunct, but the Department of Supply investigated the Westall incident very comprehensively and actually authored a comprehensive report. And Ross Coulthart has talked about that, and he's actually had sources tell him that report is legitimate. But, of course, that report has never seen the light of day. So it's either been withheld from public release or it's been destroyed. It's just one of those enduring mysteries, sadly.
Is there any level of public pressure in Australia, or is it still sort of burbling under the surface? I mean, I think it's growing here, obviously. I mean, there's a much more widespread interest now than I think than has been in a while. I'm still dubious of how much political pressure that can apply. But I'm just curious, do people just take, or do they just assume walled off from the government? They believe their own thing. I don't know. How would you?
Well, there's certainly a small pocket of folks, including myself, that continue to press the government to investigate the Westall incident. And funnily enough, only last month there was a primary school production, a musical that was put on the Westall incident called Westall the Musical. And a member of parliament, a member of the Victorian parliament, attended that primary school production. And he got up in parliament during question time only last week and formally acknowledged the Westall incident. So it was interesting to see. That's the first time it's ever happened that the Westall incident was formally raised in Victorian parliament. But I've been in a fortunate position that I've not only engaged Senator Wish Wilson, but other senators and members of parliament as well. But I've been able to develop a good relationship with Senator Wish Wilson and his office. And, you know, one of the things that I've been really grateful for is the opportunity to help inform Senator Wish Wilson's line of questioning. So obviously the senator, he has a lot of issues that his constituents take seriously. So he, like many US congressmen and women, they probably don't have the time and energy to invest the same amount of research that we do on this topic because we're heavily invested in it. We take a keen interest in it. So based on the research that I've done to date, I submitted about close to 30 questions to Senator Wish Wilson's office. This is in November of last year. And Senator Wish Wilson used his allocated time in November of last year and again in February of this year to press the current Chief of Air Force on UAP. And all of the questions that the senator asked were questions that I had proposed to him. He didn't ask all of the questions, obviously, because he only had about 8 minutes. But one of the questions that I had proposed that he asked was on the Westall incident, because the Westall incident essentially presented a clear and present safety of flight risk, because only several miles or kilometers away from the school was an airport. And so whatever it was that was observed in the skies above Westall on that day, the 6th of April, 1996, could have presented a clear safety of flight risk to inbound and outbound aircraft at Moorabbin Airport. So that's the approach that I took with my framing of a question around Westall that hasn't been asked to date, but could potentially be asked in the not too distant future. So, but short answer, no, Westall has never been raised other than, kind of conversationally in Victorian Parliament last week.
Yeah, it's. I think that's a great then public service you're doing. I mean, it's you'll be the George Knapp of Australia, and you and your fellow countryman Ross Coulthart, are can help kind of break the stories. And he was busy this week. I mean, one of the things that I was kind of thinking, like, for a couple of weeks, it feels like the forces of darkness are beginning to work their magic here. You know, things were getting settling down. Congress was quieting down. Hearings seemed to be quieting down. These SCIF meetings we were waiting to hear, where everybody was going to get the scoop from David Grush, weren't yielding anything. And then this week, last like 48 hours, things started kind of popping up a lot, having to do with Ross Coulthart's broadcast. But one of the things is I just want to get your take on, and Dave's take too, on just that it looks like the great Sean Kirkpatrick era might be coming to an end, either as planned or somehow forced out by, there was a Daily Mail article, either today or yesterday. Mm-hmm. Some of it quoting stuff from our friend Matt Ford, his podcast, and stuff that he was, had been talking about in terms of, whistleblowers not wanting to, a secret committee, and I think also whistleblowers not wanting to talk to this guy who, it looked to me like anytime he was on camera, he looked like he was in a hostage video. He did not look like a guy who was enjoying his job.
He didn't want to be there.
He seemed to hate this assignment, and it showed.
That's the story his face told.
It felt like such a, such a kind of sad rep, blue book bad version, just the same, the sort of an old playbook. What was the purpose of this whole operation? What was his purpose? I don't know, but if he's leaving, that's, I don't know, it's pretty interesting.
It is, and I think and interesting you raised the Daily Mail article, because if you folks that read that will know that apparently it's rumored that there have been four candidates already shortlisted to replace Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick. So, my whole feeling on RO is, sadly, I feel that it was set up to fail from day one, because Ronald Moultrie, who is no longer Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick's boss, it's now Kathleen Hicks, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, but Ronald Moultrie, who testified before Congress in May of last year, you'll remember, with Scott Bray. Mm-hmm. In April of this year, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, when he testified in front of Kirsten Gillibrand and the committee that she chairs, he basically said that he's got a strategic plan that's ready to go. He's got plans for this public website that are ready to go, but it hasn't been signed off. So Ronald Moultrie is the one that has the ability to sign off on all of those plans that Sean Kirkpatrick had. So why did it take RO as long as it did just to get up a simple website that you could have, done in GoDaddy in probably half a day? If you look at Aro's social media presence. They've got one tweet, and that's from July of last year. So they've had no social media engagement. And I think part of the issue is that Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, I'm still kind of a bit neutral on him. I think he's probably for a long time tried to do the best he could with what he had. But I think his hands have been tied for a long time with the fact that Ronald Moultrie hasn't signed off on a lot of the initiatives that he wanted to roll out relatively quickly. So,
and who is Ronald Moultrie? Just remind us in terms of.
I can't remember for the life of me remember his official title, but
OUDNI or something.
Yeah, USD. Yeah, so he's with the Undersecretary.
Undersecretary, Director of National Intelligence.
Yeah, so he. Yeah. And he's got a very interesting history himself as well. So the fact that he's the one that signs off on a lot of the initiatives that Sean Kirkpatrick wanted to get up and running for Aro, and there was such a gross delay on just getting basic things up and running like a website. I mean, you know, how were witnesses supposed to get in touch with Aro? They had no contact number. They had no email address publicly listed. Now they've got a website. Now they've got a reporting mechanism, not on sightings, but what US government contractors or former service members feel that they may know about UAP-related activities. So there's been, you know, these very, very slow-moving snail-like you know, progress from Aro. But if you listen to folks like Bob Salas, who was, associated with the 67 Maelstrom incident, and I know Matt Ford had another individual on his show for an interview recently, someone from the Air Force.
From Minot, yeah.
That's right. They both indicated that they were not, they had a vote of no confidence, basically, in Aro and Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, that their testimony and their recollection was not being taken seriously by the Aro investigators when, you know, their testimony was not even recorded. It was all just written down manually. The memorandum for record that was provided to Bob Salas and the other gentleman of the Mino incident, they were not really happy with what was documented in that memorandum for record and how their testimony was characterized. And I believe the individual that Matt Ford interviewed didn't actually sign off on his memorandum for record. He was not happy with how his testimony was characterized by Aro whatsoever. So you certainly have, and we've heard this time and time again from Jeremy as well as Ross Coulthart, that folks have been apprehensive to come forward to Aro and give their testimony because they feel that their testimony is not going to be taken seriously. It's not going to be comprehensively investigated. And it's just going to be Aro doing the absolute bare minimum per its legislative mandate to check a box and then move on to the next witness.
Yeah.
And there's been this he said thing with David Grush back and forth between him and Sean.
Oh, yeah. Patrick, David Grush flat out called him a liar.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and you had Sean Kirkpatrick went all guns blazing a few months ago after David Grush testified at the House Oversight Committee hearing on UAP. He went on full blast on LinkedIn.
Yes.
And then I believe he eventually deleted that LinkedIn post. But you have very much a he said, she said situation where you've got Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick saying that he and or his office had reached out to Grush, upwards of five times.
And he also claimed he hadn't spoken directly to David Grush in 5 years,
which David Grush completely refutes. So you've very much got
22.
And an easy way to confirm, you know, the old trust but verify is you've got the folks like my good friend John Greenwald Jr., who's now submitting a FOIA request to see if Aro did in fact submit calendar invitations or get documentation that validates that claim.
Yeah,
because people like Robert Salas, they received a form letter in their email.
Yeah,
from Aro. That's how they were approached.
What is this silly? So, what is this fucking game? It's just such a silly, silly fucking game that they're playing. It's like it, and so are we to assume that this the someone in Congress or maybe the senators who put their, you know, names on the bill of the whistleblower bill just were like, okay, like this is a sham. What are you guys fucking doing. I mean, if the whistleblowers only feel safe going to the Senate Armed Service, you know, Intelligence Committee, because they don't, they're not going to this place. Is it, you know, is it sort of the old style of thinking versus the new style of thinking where it's like, okay, well, we'll create Arrow, but then we'll just, you know, obviously we will slow walk this. Obviously we will do nothing. We will completely just, you know, make it the most benign, vanilla, boring thing. Whereas there are actually interested parties now in positions of power who are willing to talk about it. I don't know what to interpret from it, but it seems like that's some, this weird back and forth going on.
It's puzzling and it's concerning too. And if you've, you know, so John Greenwald Jr., he wrote a book called Inside the Black Vault, and he's done a lot of research over the years. I mean, he's been doing FOIA requests for decades. And I concur with John that it very much reeks of a repeat of Project Blue Book to a degree. I mean, if you just read the most recent...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Annual report on UAP for fiscal year 23 that came out. You read that document, if you read between the lines, it's basically Arrow saying, you know, we can explain all of these away. It's all going to end up being prosaic. There might be 1 or 2% of cases that unresolved that require further investigation. And that's what we care about, the 1 to 2%. Just like with Project Blue Book, it was 1-2% of cases, about 750 cases that were unresolved. So we don't give a stuff about what becomes someone else's
problem.
We know
problem. Our balloons.
And SEP, as Kirkpatrick framed it in April, we want to know about those 1-2%, and you know, whatever it is, prosaic or exotic, they're the ones that we care about.
Well, I think that's what J. Allen Hynek said about the Condon report. He said that the only cases that should have been in the study were the ones they couldn't resolve.
Exactly.
He said all the other ones we knew from the outset they weren't UFOs.
History repeats itself, sadly, and I think that's what we're seeing happen now. So it's, I think if Kirkpatrick is out and someone new is in, hopefully they will, you know, have a little bit more of a willingness to, you know, get to the bottom of what this is and be more transparent with the American public and the rest of the world.
I vote Dave Foley.
I'm not a citizen. I'm not sure if I'm eligible.
Oh God, you had to be Canadian. What's the matter with you?
But I was gonna say when this
perfect
before it became Arrow, back when it was the incomprehensible AIMSOG. Even then, I think it was like Lou Elizondo had expressed his reservations. He said, "Well, this is being overseen by the people that caused me to retire from the military." You know, these were the same people that were obstructing my attempts to, you know, to get this information to my superiors. So,
isn't it funny that when the deputy secretary for defense, Kathleen Hicks, stepped in, within days, ARA's website went online. So, you know, Ronald Moultrie was clearly not getting anything done, for ARA with Sean Kirkpatrick at the helm. But now that you have Kathleen Hicks at the helm, potentially, that may be an encouragement, but then, I mean, if you just listen to Kathleen Hicks she did an interview with, John Stewart from The Daily Show, and he's saying that, you know, the U.S. Department of Defense has never passed an audit, and you've got these trillions of dollars that unaccounted for. I mean, that doesn't instill a whole lot of confidence in the American taxpaying public either, that, you know, Kathleen Hicks is unable to account for any of those dollars, and she's the one that signs the checks basically for ARRA. So
I think we'll see, I guess we'll see the direction this is headed with who they bring in, right? Because if this is a sort of ally of the kind of movement or support of all of this, that, you know, this could, it could be a, you know, if it feels like someone has sort of been pulled out of some bureaucracy, will be, you know, who doesn't seem like they want to be there. But I don't know. I took it this as a moment of potential optimism that they could turn it into a real thing, as opposed to this silly, you know, this silly game. Yeah. And Blue Book is such
modern Blue Book.
Well, and Blue Book is now synonymous for a kind of fraudulent exercise, you know, meant to deceive, you know, and
debunk,
and yet, you know, they continue to try to sort of play the same game. But it does feel like there's so much more. And maybe it's just the pure presence of social media and just people asking questions and people like yourself, Grant, like FOIA requests. It's there is this inability to be utterly opaque. I mean, obviously, there is still such a level of it that is, but maybe parts of that, like enough needles in it, you know, enough light can kind of shine through. But it does, it will be interesting to see whether he was pushed out or whether he had planned to leave. If he is, in fact, leaving, that will be that'd be a good moment to get some new energy in there.
And look, I mean, there are some questions, some serious questions that need to be asked of Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, because it's the likes of Ross Coulthard and other citizen journalists that take this topic seriously. And largely the legacy news media is not covering this topic seriously, with the exception of News Nation, who I think has done a really good job to, you know, deliver coverage on this topic. But you have these revelations that Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick is now potentially off getting a job with you know, one of the Oak Ridge Labs, which is an offshoot of Battelle, which is, you know, I mean, is there a huge perception of a conflict of interest there if Battelle is one of the...
Maybe we
tell us what Battelle is. Yeah, what is that?
Well, will you tell them?
well, Battelle's one of those. So Battelle's been around for many, many decades, and it's long been rumored that whatever it was that crashed at Roswell, wreckage was eventually shipped off to Battelle for analysis. And there has been long rumors of metamaterials that have been in the possession of Battelle that it's been trying to analyze and reverse engineer. So Battelle has long been suspected as a player in the reverse engineering or crash retrieval, the legacy program, I suppose.
What is its its advertised purpose? I mean, what is it as a company? What is it?
So they're a huge defense contractor. I mean, I think they do a lot of stuff for defense, but I don't know enough about Battelle. I mean, there is one there are a few folks on social media that have done some deep dives on Battelle and its potential links to you know, retrieval of debris from Roswell. But certainly there appears to be this anecdotal link between Roswell and Battelle, that's for sure. So,
well, then clearly Sean Kirkpatrick is serious about getting to the bottom of this.
Well,
so that's why he's going to work.
Or getting rich off it or something, you know.
Yeah. But it's, you know, just more, it leaves more questions than answers, it does, I'm afraid. But to your point, Tom, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And it definitely sounds like it's broke. So change could be a good thing for ARRO.
I mean, it'll make a huge difference. I mean, whoever they appoint, if it is somebody who's going to, you know, not be obstructionist and not be, you know, clearly, because Moultrie, clearly their whole plan was just, I think they really just hope people would lose interest.
I agree.
Like they did their boring, demonstration where they couldn't even pause a video and, you know.
Exactly. Well, and it's the likes of, you know, folks, I mean, irrespective of what you think of his policies, it's the likes of, you know, Burchett and Anna Paulina Luna. These guys are really carrying the torch and pushing hard to get some answers, for the American public and, you know, promote greater transparency. And, you know, the fact that you now have a new Speaker of the House who might be potentially UAP friendly, I mean, you know, who knows? Is there a chance for a select committee on UAP to now be created for the House Oversight Committee? And if that happens and they get subpoena authority, then that's a whole different ballgame. You know, you get the House Oversight Committee would get, I believe, Title 50 authority specifically for a select committee, and they could compel people to come and testify. And in addition to that, you've now got also this historic proposed legislation that hopefully Biden will sign off on at the end of the year, the UAP Disclosure Act, where the president has to appoint a 9-member board who is tasked with disclosing all documentation, all records on UAP that are older than 25 years. And it can only withhold information if it deems release of information to be a national security threat. So there are there are a couple of things happening that could really make 2024, I think, a really interesting interesting year. So
it certainly will challenge the kind of established government thing, like the things like that, the committee, which I agree, like it sounds great. Schumer's legislation is, there's almost no disguising that
ties,
for like,
and it ties the president to it, which I think is hugely important.
Yeah. I mean, the committee, I mean, there is a strategy where you can say like, we are acknowledging this is a huge important issue. And so we're going to put this incredibly august body together to study this thing and then come out with, you know, like, and now that we have, you know, like they can definitely, there's a way to still conceal, but, I think they are adopting every strategy possible because the dam is giving way a little bit. And I just remain amazed that the Grush hearings, like, dropped like this bomb in the middle of the culture. And, you know, and then you had Arrow over here kind of like, well, we're really looking into, you know, some stuff like there, like they were right there for the and yet those two things couldn't connect. Was the most absurd, and that's why people had to be like, what the fuck are you doing over there?
I mean, Kirkpatrick actually saying he's insulting the Department of Defense.
it's in that part.
He's hurting their feelings.
It's an important story for your whole thing to exist that Grush just said, like. You know, and they just like, I don't know, I didn't think to ask for the address of where the UFO was. It just didn't, you know, when I was thinking about that, I'm like, there's some, you know, he said to let, or somebody come forward, because nobody has either put him, and it would seem like the Grush forces would win this round if Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick is on the outs. And if there is truth to the fact that whistleblowers like, I'm not going to talk to that guy. That lends more credence to Grush that he is believed by important folks, because otherwise you would think that, you know, Arrow would be kind of winning the PR battle on that front, but it doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be the opposite.
And at the same time, there's a lot of semantics and games being played as well. I mean, you have Kirsten Gillibrand who's saying she hasn't yet met with Grush because she wasn't prepared to pay for Grush's lodgings to Washington to have a sit down with him. And you see how quickly people on social media say, Jesus, I'll create a GoFundMe page and get Grush to Washington if that's the problem. But I'm surprised that, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand didn't try and coordinate with David Grush's appearance at the House Oversight Committee for some time to be set aside to sit down with him.
She did seem to be trying to find an exit from the issue.
She took her foot off the gas for sure. I mean,
And she was trying to sort of say, oh yeah, I did write this legislation, but it wasn't really about UFOs. Kind of, she was sort of presenting that face to the world, which
maybe, and that could be. I don't know if it would be a political. I don't know if it would be a political albatross if she was a proponent of this issue. I think people, in other words, I don't think if someone was like, she's the UFO senator, would be. I took it as like, oh well, she bought the argument from someone in the, you know, deep background who said, best we not pursue this hard or go this hard at it. And she's seems to, cause she hasn't disowned it. She's just starting to talk in that word salad way. with those kind of weak excuses and weak tea that you're suggesting, Grant, of like, oh, yeah, we just didn't get his best Western bill sorted.
Yeah, I mean, she went hard initially. You know, she was really the champion, and now she's kind of backed off a bit. So
it did seem like she got gun-shy.
Yeah.
So, well, if you read about like Tom DeLonge, there was some monologue I was reading about him, his whole take on it, which I mean, it's a grim diagnosis of the whole phenomenon. So it's kind of, you know, maybe you don't want to rush that out into the public sphere immediately. It's, you know, best left unsolved.
Yeah. Unsaid. Well, I had actually a question I had for you guys, being in, you know, in the industry and in Hollywood. It was only yesterday that there was the formal launch of the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance. Did you guys did you hear about that?
Nobody told me about this, Dave, and I would expect you to be my conduit to this kind of shit.
I was asked to be on the board, and I forgot about it.
Interesting.
Oh,
I forgot
about it.
I forgot to. I said sure, and then they asked for a bio and a photo, and I never got around to it.
Chrissy, isn't there something we could have done about that? I mean, couldn't we have intercepted this somehow? That Dave on the board,
if we wanted to. Yeah,
and now Grant's asking about it.
There's an interesting mix of folks that are associated with that. I mean, obviously, it's an initiative that's being spearheaded by Stephen Bassett, who we know has long been an activist on this topic, but. Yeah. You've got some, you know, Thomas
Bryce
Jane. Bryce Abel.
Is he on
Tom Jane is a Hollywood member. So you got a pretty interesting cross section of folks that are in the industry that are in Hollywood that are a part of this alliance.
And their mission is to serve as involved with it as well.
Yeah. Yep. He's part of it.
Because he's one of the people who reached out to me about it, and I forgot.
Yeah, I mean, I read on their website that their mission is to really be content connectors, so that they can unify, address the truth embargo and get Hollywood starting to report more factual information in their content.
Yes, tell better stories about
better stories. About UAP, but I mean, who does everyone? Does anyone really know the facts on the whole, you know, ET UAP thing? I mean,
I think there's still a lot. Like, no. I think LA is like Washington in a way, where you're going to find people that are really interested and sympathetic to the issue, and people that still maintain a real kind of, you know, kind of skepticism and like don't touch it, and you know, be like, oh, do we want to? I think there is an awareness, and that's why, you know, Los Angeles and Hollywood, you know, they're gonna go toward the audience, and I think the audience is very interested, and I think there is a demand for content and story. Whether that's gonna be, and maybe an organization like this will be helpful and fruitful in making sure that that's sort of accurate and not kind of hyperbolic or unreliable, or turn it into, you know, Sasquatch or whatever. But I think there's a demand that they'll acknowledge, and yet I think at certain levels it's still, you know, people want to talk about it privately and are super interested and like kind of want to get the scoop, but I don't think people are still willing to quite be out there about it.
I would love to have seen Kurt Russell get on the board, or I mean, hell yeah. we know who's come out publicly and so, I mean, I actually did the second video that I did on my channel was a deep dive of Kurt Russell's encounter with the Phoenix Lights, because I'm a huge Kurt Russell fan, have been ever since I was a young fella.
I've worked with Kurt.
You have, right?
Yeah, we did a movie called Sky High together.
Oh, of course, that's right. Yes, yes.
I played his sidekick.
Oh, yeah, right. And
how was Kurt? Tell us the truth, Dave. Was he nice, he Kurt?
Was fantastic.
Was he good to you?
Oh, good.
Oh, I loved him. He was fantastic. He was very
good to hear.
You know, I mean, obviously, Kurt and I don't agree on politics, but he was really fun to be around. And
I've heard that about them, that he's a very grounded bloke, and he loves to have a laugh. He doesn't take himself too seriously. And actually, what was interesting was I was actually able to uncover some new information. I don't know if you've seen the episode I did, but I was able to uncover some new information that had never been reported previously on Kurt Russell's encounter with the Phoenix Lights.
No.
What was that?
So, well, I'll give you a spoiler alert for those that are watching.
And we will guide people to your podcast.
Yes.
So 13th of March, obviously 1997, Kurt Russell, we know from his interview on the BBC The One Show in 2017 when he was promoting Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, he admitted to the world that he was the general aviation pilot that reported to traffic control at the Phoenix Lights as he was on approach with his son, Oliver Hudson. And in that interview on the BBC's The One Show, he quoted the tail sign of the aircraft that he was flying to Phoenix, which was Two Tango Sierra. And when I watched that interview only last year, because I saw Dr. Lynn Kitai, who's done a lot of research on Phoenix Lights, she appeared on Inside the Black Vault with John Greenwald, and that kind of sparked my interest in revisiting Kurt's account. But when I heard Kurt say those three words, Two Tango Sierra, the tail sign, I remember I had heard that before. And being a diehard Kurt Russell fan, I consulted the Oracle, went through my DVD collection of Kurt Russell films. And have you both seen Executive Decision, 1996?
I think I probably did. Yes, maybe not several times, but I think I saw it at least once. Yes.
So if you remember back to the opening scene with Kurt Russell's character David Grant in that film, where he's learning to become a pilot, he's piloting a single propeller, you know, light aircraft. He's doing his flying lessons, and he's flying. He's on approach to land in this, you know, this single propeller plane. And he quotes the words in the film, Two Tango Sierra. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the aircraft that he flew in Executive Decision was the very same plane that he flew to Phoenix on the 13th of March, 1997. And to keep the synchronicity train going, the actor that is in that scene with Kurt Russell that plays his flight instructor, his name is John Rixey Moore. He's good friends with Kurt Russell. And he actually also has had his own sightings and is very well versed on the UFO topic. But that's actually his aircraft. He owned that aircraft. And so I was able to track down John Rixey Moore and get him on my channel and have an interview with him. And we talked about that plane, and he shared details of, you know, what it's like from the interior, the perspective looking out from the over the dashboard and so on. So it was just obviously didn't reveal any information about what the Phoenix Lights was or weren't, but I just found it another piece of the puzzle that had not been.
Did you find out how much he charged production for the use of the plane?
I think
he stole the plane.
Yeah, I've heard about
outfits and costumes. I haven't heard that someone took off with an entire plane.
Well, so Kurt actually asked John Rixey Moore to be in the film. So I think he did it as a pro bono, as a freebie, to get a nice little co-starring role, role in the film.
Well, another interesting thing about Kurt's thing was that, like many people who have an experience with a UFO, he and his son saw it, and then they never spoke about it.
Yeah.
For years. He said they didn't talk about it for years, and he didn't think about it until he saw Goldie Hawn was watching a documentary about UFOs, and they talked about the Phoenix Lights, and they were talking about
his logbooks, and he was able to verify.
What did he see any in relation to what they were seeing on the ground? Was there any more detail or specification about, or did they see, it was the triangle, right? I mean, it was a giant.
There's a bank of six lights running back over the airport. So Oliver said to Kurt, you know, hey, Pa, what are those? And, you know, looking at the six lights, and Kurt said he didn't know. So he called into air traffic control and said, you know, what are you guys painting tonight over the airport? And they said they weren't seeing anything. And they said, well, what are you seeing? And Kurt said, I'm seeing six lights running back over the airport, and thinking this could potentially be a safety of flight issue if he's coming into land. And he's never really gone beyond what he stated in his interview on the BBC's The One Show in 2017. And then he was on Jimmy Kimmel the following year, where he talked about it again. So I reached out to Kurt, and also through his sister, Jamie Way, who runs Kurt's boutique winery business, Gogi. He has his own boutique wine. And Kurt, unfortunately, doesn't want to, he's not doing a lot of interviews these days, and apparently not talking talking about his sighting. So if you're still chums with Kurt, Dave,
I haven't seen him in a long time.
But you still have the spandex.
Try and quiz him on his sighting, because I think it'll be fascinating to learn more about his encounter. Yeah.
The speaking of lights, one of the other stories that sort of broke this week was that there was this apparently, as confirmed from three sources to Ross Coulthard, and then including Chris Mellon, who the former Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there was it was reported that there was 8 UAPs in the Arctic Circle that jets were scrambled to intercept.
Oh, I didn't hear about this.
Yeah. I was. I mean, did you hear anything about that, Grant? I mean, it sounded like it happened fairly recently.
So I had known that Ross was working on that story and doing some investigative journalism on it. I didn't know the extent of his reporting until it came out on News Nation. But yeah, pretty fascinating revelation that you had reports of NORAD scrambling fighter jets, which it denies. But Ross has heard that from a number of sources that there were up to 8 UAP detected in the Arctic Circle in the days leading up to the shootdown of the Chinese spy balloon.
This was sort of related to the Alaska shootdown, right?
Yeah.
Your show, Ross, also mentioned that one of the objects that was supposedly shot down, the one over the Yukon, that Ross Coulthard was reporting that the pilot said the missile hit the object, but the object was not damaged and just kept on going.
Well, so that was the Dead Horse Alaska one. So that's the one that's has a lot of questions about it still. So you have the Pentagon coming out and saying that the U.S. Air Force fired on this unidentified aerial object that it encountered in Dead Horse, Alaska, and that you had obviously in the days after that event, Kirby, I can't remember his name, full name, but John, John Kirby, he
National Security,
National Security. Yeah, he's at the podium, is at the and telling the world that they believe it will be a straightforward effort to retrieve debris because that they believe it was frozen ice, frozen water that the debris fell down. But there has been no evidence presented to date to suggest that anything was retrieved. In fact, the Pentagon has said that it wasn't able to retrieve anything of that Alaska shootdown. And Ross is saying that attempts to bring it down were unsuccessful, that they did fire a missile at it and something was ejected from the object or was dislodged from the object, was broken off and did fall. But then they weren't able to, then the object just, it didn't necessarily disappear, but could not be intercepted. So it's what's so frustrating about the those three unidentified aerial objects that were shot down in February is that the Pentagon will be very quick to release U2 footage from the cockpit of the Chinese spy balloon, and it will release footage
100%
that's taken MQ-9 Reaper drones of the Russian fighters dousing dousing the drones, and now this Chinese fighter jet that was only 10 feet away from the US asset that's getting filmed. They'll happily release that footage and that FLIR footage, but they have not released any footage to date pertaining to the shootdown of those three unidentified aerial objects. So the White House is certainly not staying true to its promise of being transparent with the American public. And that's what Biden said at the podium in February. So it's, it doesn't instill a lot of confidence in the White House and the Pentagon that they'll happily release footage that supports their strategic narrative, but they're not going to release footage pertaining to UAP.
See, it's so funny because CNN and it's interesting now that there's this story about these 8 UAP in the kind of in the in the run up to that, that and apparently the jets were scrambled. They could not sort of intercept or engage. These things went away. NORAD says that they did not go to intercept this stuff, but there were jets there on a training mission. So they're acknowledging that the planes were there in case some radar somewhere can show them there. They're like, oh no, it was all training. But the shootdowns was CNN that day was breathlessly talking. They had quotes from the pilots straight away, which was sort of odd. And they were very much using the language, the UAP language. They were saying these things had no propulsion. They had no visible means of propulsion. They had no, you know, there was no airstrip. I mean, I remember the weekend anchor was almost talking from the UAP thesaurus in terms of like what you would sort of look for, which is no vapor trail. And yeah, I have said the same thing repeatedly. Supposedly this electronics and photographic science is so classified, you can never show it from the jet unless you want to just push your news story that day, in which case, fine, totally declassified. It doesn't matter at all. Yeah. You know exactly what cameras
we have. And that all UFOs are just weather balloons.
Weather balloons, you know? Yep.
Yeah.
And what's so frustrating, and this is how it ties back to Australia. So in February of this year, at the Senate estimates hearing, which is kind of like a budget oversight hearing in Australia. So Senator Wish Wilson was asking the current Chief of Air Force, Air Marshal Robert Chipman, about the shoot down events in the United States and basically RAF's thoughts on that. And the Air Marshal admitted that the Royal Australian Air Force had sought information and a briefing from the United States via the air attaché in Washington, D.C., on all four of those events, the Chinese spy balloon and the unidentified aerial objects. And the follow-up question that Senator Wish Wilson had is, well, why did you seek that additional information? And the response that came back from the air marshal was, we wanted to identify the source of the objects, their origin, and we wanted to see what learnings we could gain from the US's response to those incidents, because the US Department of Defense has told us that, and President Biden has told us that, those objects were shot down or brought down, or they were ordered to have them shot down because they represented a clear and present safety of flight risk. And in the case of the Chinese spy balloon, a potential national security threat, you know, surveillance. So, The Royal Australian Air Force will happily seek information and a briefing from the United States on those objects because it represented a national security threat and a safety of flight risk, but it will not touch the UAP topic and seek a briefing from the US Department of Defense, even though UAP represent exactly the same threat, safety of flight risk and national security threat. And so there's this double standard being played in this hypocrisy in the Australian Department of Defense at the moment. It's playing these games, and is just not acknowledging that UAP is an issue, which is so frustrating.
It is frustrating indeed. But that apparently the Department of Defense said that that they will release some information about these shootdowns.
And it will be interesting to see what that information is. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So whether that is because apparently those cases did go to ARRO, I believe, and has ARRO investigated those incidents and is in a position to now have information released about it. So it'll certainly be interesting as to what imagery and data the US is able to release on those shootdown events.
Now,
and it's long overdue. I mean, that happened back in February. November. Yeah. You know,
do you feel like this subject is gaining more traction with the public in Australia? I mean, obviously the government isn't doing anything for it, but is there a spillover from what's going on in the US in Australia?
I think so. I think more people are starting to take the topic seriously. What doesn't help in Australia is that the legacy news media in Australia is very slow to pick up take the baton. They'll report on what happens in the US, but they'll always play the bloody X-Files theme during every segment, and they still take the piss out of the topic. And I think it's still the case in probably reporting in the US. So I've been long pushing for the Australian news media to start taking the topic seriously and ask the questions that I'm being asking, because I'm just one dude that has a couple of hundred followers on his channel, whereas the news media, particularly these breakfast shows, Sunrise in particular is one I always call out, they'll often have the Prime Minister or the Deputy Prime Minister, who's also the Minister for Defence, Richard Marles, on their show in the morning, pressing them on important topics that, you know, they feel Australians should care about. So the Australian news media has really dropped the ball in covering this topic in a serious manner. But there is a changing of the tide, because I had submitted to the Australian House of Representatives in June of this year a petition for the House of Representatives to consider conducting a formal review of Australia's position on UAP and implement an investigatory body on UAP to assess the potential national security threats and safety of flight risk that UAP pose, because there's a clear domain awareness gap if Australia's not taking this topic seriously. So that petition, it secured 759 signatures, which I was really quite nice. Amazed at. I was expecting only a few folks to sign off on it. That's currently sitting with the Minister for Defence to provide a written response to that petition. So a journalist had seen that, an Australian journalist had seen that petition and reached out to me, because he was able to track down my details as the author of the petition. And he wanted to run a news story on the Australian Department of Defence's challenge their complete lack of interest and inaction on the UAP topic, namely the fact that Australia did not attend the, you know, the Department of Defense Australia was saying that Australia did not attend the Five Eyes Forum on UAP. So I provided some background information to that journalist, and I recommended that that journalist reach out to Ross Coulthart, which he did. So Ross Coulthart and I are quoted significantly throughout this article that came out only about a week and a half ago in the Canberra Times, which is Canberra's in the Australian Capital Territory in Australia. That's where our government is. So it was a double spread in this Canberra Times newspaper, which a lot of people in government would have read, and it really challenges the Australian Department of Defence's complete inaction on the topic and the fact that defence personnel have actually been taking the piss out of the topic. They've been treating it like a joke. So that was, for me, an interesting turning point, because I think more and more media outlets are going to start to take a serious tone on this topic and ask these sorts of questions. Well, our Five Eyes ally is taking this topic incredibly seriously. New Zealand was represented at this Five Eyes Forum. Canada was. The UK is not saying anything at all, but there was a really good article in the Debrief just yesterday, I believe, on UK's inaction on the UAP topic. And I think there'll be more and more media outlets. In fact, I know there will be more media outlets that cover the UAP topic and do it from a serious tone rather than taking the piss and claiming that it's all science fiction.
Yeah, well, I know I've been watching Jeremy Corbell has been doing a lot of interviews with Australian outlets over the last year.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that gradually, when, like, especially with outlets that he's done more than one interview, sometimes he's done three or four interviews with them, that they stop playing the X-Files scene.
Yes.
Eventually. I think Jeremy has shamed them into not playing it anymore.
Good. Yeah.
And you know, and they stop giggling when they introduce him. So
yeah, I agree. And I think NBC has done a pretty good
Gotti Schwartz is doing it, but they're only letting him do limited reporting apparently over at NBC now, and MSNBC is not, and NBC proper, the network, they have a blackout pretty much.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, I don't, yeah, and I'm not sure which outlets, and I was probably watching through X or Twitter or whatever we want to call it now, but the, you know, I think, Grant, I think that's, you know, I think that's significant. I think it's about kind of shaming some of this sort of tired old playbook, and yep. And I think, as you know, you pursue that, and as sort of, you know, citizen researchers and journalists and you know, activists continue to kind of push, I think it's beginning to shift the trend, because I do like the reports now. You're seeing less and less of that in the States. Now, it's not like they're covering it every night as the top headlines, but it's you don't quite get that. Some of this is to Ross Coulthart's credit. You know, I think he's had some great he's broken some really interesting stories that are hard to refute. You know, I
100%.
Mean, Grush has tried to sort of slander him, but they haven't been able to really. I think that was really unsuccessful, that effort to kind of just cast him off as out of his mind because he had PTSD. Dave and I, a lot of people just, you know, we all reacted very like virulently to that. It's disgraceful.
It was repugnant in so many ways.
Yeah. Disgraceful. And a sign that they had nothing on him, really.
Yeah.
It's kind of a sad spectacle, but I applaud your efforts to continue to sort of break through.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah,
well, look, I give a hell of a lot of credit to Jeremy and Ross as well, because they've obviously got, you know, folks that are defense personnel in the military that are feeling comfortable to come forward with their information to Jeremy and Ross, and they're entrusting them with that information. And to Jeremy and Ross's credit, they understand the golden rule of investigative journalism. You don't reveal the identity of a source, or you don't reveal information that could potentially jeopardize the safety, well-being, or security of a source, or reveal information that's going to potentially harm national security. And one of the things that Ross has said, this is going back as only recently as when I had him on my podcast in August, he's saying that there are defense personnel that are coming to him concerned and sharing with him details of their sighting of something anomalous in Australian airspace that they're concerned about, but they're not feeling comfortable or confident to report to their superiors out of fear of reprisals or being ostracized, or that their report be not taken seriously and then potentially having a blemish on their flight record. And that in itself is the potential national security threat. If folks aren't prepared to come forward with their account of what they're seeing that they're not able to reconcile in the skies, because if it is foreign adversarial, that's another big problem we've got. And so folks, pilots and aviators aren't reporting that because there's a fear of reprisal and stigma that's attached to it, and the fact that Australia has no reporting mechanisms in place. So if you submit a report, what happens to it? It doesn't go anywhere. The official line of the Royal Australian Air Force is if you're a member of the public or the military and you see a UAP, call the cops. That's their recommendation. Mm-hmm. Call the cops or reach out to your civilian UFO organization like MUFON or some of the others that are out there. So that's why there's another big element that's a concern as well.
Yeah. In Canada, you're told just to go down to your local Tim Hortons.
What's Tim Hortons? What's
it's a donut shop.
Right.
Just go to Timmy's. Go to Timmy's. Just tell the cashier.
Dunk the donut and the coffee, and away you go. Right. Yeah. So.
Well, listen. this is a great conversation to continue, and we hope we can have you back and catch up on what is how progress is going in Australia on this issue, because sounds like you're starting to dent some doors a little bit, and that's great.
I think I've become a thorn in the side of the Royal Australian Air Force with all the FOIA requests that I've done.
Annoy them. That's great.
Yeah. But look, I really appreciate it. I'd love to come back on. I appreciate you giving me some time with you guys and sharing some insights and Australian perspectives with the audience. So it's been a lot of fun.
It's been awesome.
It's good to hear what's going on in other parts of the Commonwealth.
Yeah.
Exactly. Even if it's very little.
Well, I'm sure it's a lot, and it's just the upfront is they're kind of sticking by that old school approach, which is just intimidate and make them fear for their jobs and do all that kind of stuff. But hopefully that will change.
And I think too, one of the things I've been pushing for is strength in numbers. Like I'm just one guy, so a lot of people that follow me on social media or watch the podcast that I do, I encourage them, if you are really concerned that Australia is not taking this topic seriously and the topic's important to you, write, email, call, tweet your member of parliament or Australian senator, or get in touch with the legacy media and let them know that this is an important topic that Australia should take seriously, because the more and more everyday advocates for this topic like myself that can push for greater transparency and scrutiny, I think only helps potentially move the ball along for Australia. So and that's here. The goal anyway.
Yeah, crossed. And here, I mean, I think it's totally worth reminding listeners and viewers to, you know, that does make a difference. Like, leave a message, talk to somebody in the staff room. There are a lot of sympathetic ears to this issue. Like in California, Adam Schiff, who's running for Senate, and you know, the yep. open seat now, vacated, you know, with Dianne Feinstein passing away, you know, but he's pretty good on this. There are ways to get heard and make sure that they're still pushing. And I think it's good. That's a good reminder for everyone, wherever you are, if you're interested in this, to stay loud about it. Awesome. Well, great to meet you, sir. Enjoy.
Likewise.
Your
Likewise. Thank
we'll
you
keep
for your
listening.
Time.
And
yeah, thanks a lot, Grant.
We'll keep apprised of all of this, and we will.
We'll try to find an excuse to come to Australia.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And, can we figure that out? That's good. Yeah. Let's do that. Let's figure that out.
Keep me posted if you get in touch with Kurt again, Dave. I'd love to know.
I will.
Oh, yeah. I will. I want to know about that, too. Yeah. Thanks so much,
Very Ray. Good. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
All right. Bye. Cheers.